Welcome to American Heritage on Voice Corps. My name is John Matthew Stockhausen. For the next hour, I'll read about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The Great Lakes, Superior, Michigan, Huron, Erie, and Ontario, have played an important role in the development of America since the 17th century, when they formed a convenient route for the first European explorers of the central and northern expanses of the North American continent. The lakes became, in the industrial era, a crucial highway, permitting the transfer of raw materials and finished goods into and out of the American heartland, permitting cities like Chicago and Cleveland to flourish. The Great Lakes, though, have a less benevolent side. Shallow, cold waters, rocks and shoals, difficult currents, and frequent storms make the lakes difficult and dangerous to navigate. More than 6,000 boats have been lost to the lakes in the post-colonial period, starting with the Griffon, belonging to the French explorer La Salle in 1679. While Little Lake Erie has claimed the most ships, the Great Lakes' largest and most famous victim went down in Lake Superior. The Edmund Fitzgerald, a 17-year-old, 729-foot-long, 13,000-ton iron ore carrier, sank in a storm on November 10, 1975, about 17 miles offshore near Sault Ste. Marie at the eastern end of the lake. The sinking of the Fitzgerald resonated in American popular culture as only a few shipwrecks ever have, inspiring a hit folk song, numerous documentaries and expeditions, and an enduring interest in the mystery and tragedy of her loss. I will be reading from the book Mighty Fitz by Michael Schumacher. On Saturday, November 8, 1975, a low-pressure weather system formed in the southwestern portion of the United States. Its edge, ranging from southern California across northern Arizona to central Colorado. The system moved eastward at a steady pace, pulling with it cold air from the Rocky Mountains. As it moved over the Oklahoma Panhandle, its air rotating counterclockwise, the system pulled in moisture from the Gulf of Mexico and warm air from Texas. Storm clouds formed, and the National Weather Service predicted rain. On that same day, a low-pressure system in Alberta, Canada, began moving eastward across southern Canada and the northern third of the United States. This system pulled frigid Arctic air in its wake, setting off forecasts for snow in the north-central states of the U.S. Such weather patterns are not uncommon during the transition month of November, when jet streams and upper air patterns create strong and sometimes unpredictable weather systems. By the time the low-pressure system in the southern United States had reached central Kansas at 7 o'clock in the morning of November 9th, the National Weather Service was confident in forecasting a typical November storm for much of the central states and the upper Great Lakes. The storm would move north and east at a rapid pace, pass over Lake Superior, and wind up over James Bay, Ontario. The Canadian system continued its eastward trek, bringing down more cold air from Canada. The National Weather Service kept a close watch on this system, concerned about what might happen if it slammed into the system, moving up from the southwest. Moored at the Burlington Northern Railroad dock in Superior, Wisconsin, at dawn on November 9, 1975, the SS Edmund Fitzgerald was bound to catch the attention of anyone looking in its direction. At 729 feet, the Mighty Fitz, as the ship was often called, ranked among the largest vessels ever to sail on the Great Lakes, and even seasoned veterans were impressed by the ore carrier's size and strength. The Fitzgerald was a blue-collar vessel, capable of hauling mind-boggling tonnage around the lakes, but with its handsome red-and-white paint, beautiful pilot house and twin staterooms, state-of-the-art equipment, and comfortable living quarters, it also boasted a modern beauty that other big freighters could only envy. The Fitzgerald was one of the hardest working ships in the business, had been at the Superior dock for only a few hours, and it would be gone in a few more. Over the past week, it had sailed from Toledo, Ohio, to Silver Bay, Minnesota, a port about 50 miles north of Superior, where it had picked up a full load of taconite iron ore pellets and taken off for Ashtabula, Ohio. Then it was back up the length of Lake Superior for another cargo here in Superior. On this early Sunday morning, the Fitzgerald was waiting to be loaded for a routine run to Great Lakes Steel, a Zug Island processing plant near Detroit. On the spar deck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, First Mate Jack McCarthy supervised the removal of the ship's hatch covers. He had already delivered the loading order to the dock, and he was eager to get started. His crew was on the clock, and since it was a Sunday, they would be paid overtime. Not an agreeable situation for Ernest McSorley, the Fitzgerald's veteran, cost-conscious captain. One had to be careful when removing or replacing the rectangular 7-ton hatch covers. McCarthy had been through the process on countless occasions over his 40 years of service on the Great Lakes, but he knew all too well that a blunder could seriously damage the hatch combings or seals and threaten a ship's watertight integrity. Only a year earlier, in September 1974, the crew had tried to lift a hatch cover before all the clamps had been unfastened, damaging the cover, the combing, and a few clamps. The Fitz had 21 11-by-48-foot cargo openings running down its spar deck, each opening covered by, in effect, a large, flat lid. Each of the red covers was fastened down to a combing by 68 clamps. The covers, constructed from thick sheets of steel, were taken off and replaced by a hatch crane that moved up and down the length of the ship on tracks. The Fitzgerald's cargo hold was divided into three sections, separated by screen bulkheads. By the time this particular loading was completed, the Fitz would have taken on 26,116 long tons of taconite pellets. The distribution of cargo was critical, and McCarthy had carefully drawn up a loading sequence that assured the Fitz would stay on an even keel throughout the loading. Uneven distribution of cargo could place too much stress on a ship's hull, and in the worst-case scenario could crack or even sink the ship. The middle of the Fitz was especially vulnerable. If the ship hogged, that is, bent downward at the bow and stern ends, during loading, the hull could be seriously damaged. Poor loading had caused countless vessels to bottom out in shallow docking waters, leading to costly damage and delays. Fortunately, the Fitz had so far escaped such mishaps. Loading the Fitz ate up just under 6 hours. The last pocket was emptied into the hold, the ship's fuel tanks were topped off with 50,000 gallons of No. 6 fuel oil, and the dock crew started fastening down the hatch clamps. Crewmen hosed down the deck, clearing it of loose taconite pellets and a film of pellet dust. In the chart room behind the wheelhouse, Captain McSorley looked over the map of Lake Superior and ran over his mental checklist of the early portion of the Fitzgerald's journey across the northern part of the lake. The Fitz would spend the rest of the day heading in a northeasterly direction before turning and heading southeast to the Sault Ste. Marie locks. The entire trip from Superior to Detroit measured around 700 miles and would take just over 2 days. If the weather held, the Fitz would be docking at the Zug Island Harbor sometime around 5 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon. The deck crew was still dogging down the Fitzgerald's hatch covers when the ship pulled away from the dock. Jack McCarthy waved to the dock crew as the Fitz set out. "So long, boys," McCarthy called to the men. "Good luck." It was just before 2 p.m. when the Fitz made its way through the breakwater and onto Lake Superior, its engine set at full ahead, the Wisconsin shore line receding by the minute. The ship was in its element. 2.5 hours after the Edmund Fitzgerald set out, another huge ore carrier, the SS Arthur M. Anderson, left port at Two Harbors, Minnesota, under Captain Bernie Cooper. The weather was still warm, and the seas quiet, with waves coming in little more than ripples. The Anderson, carrying a full load of taconite pellets, was bound for Gary, Indiana. As Captain Cooper directed his ship out of the breakwater and onto open water, he could make out another ship on the lake behind him. It was a beautiful, clear November day, Cooper recalled. As we backed out of Two Harbors, we could see on the horizon the Fitzgerald. We knew it was the Fitzgerald because we heard her security report coming out of Superior. It would only be a matter of time before the Fitzgerald, the faster of the two ships, overtook him, but it would be good to have another ship around if the weather took a turn for the worse. By early evening on November 9th, the Edmund Fitzgerald was encountering the anticipated deteriorating weather conditions. The wind was blowing harder and the seas were choppy. But from the perspective of those occupying the Fitzgerald's pilot house, it was business as usual. The Fitz just moved along steadily at about 15 miles per hour. It had yet to catch up to the Anderson, but that would happen sometime during the night. If all went well, the Fitzgerald would be passing just south of Isle Royale around midnight. By that time, most of the crew would have quit playing cards or watching television and settled into their rooms. By the early morning hours of November 10th, Captain McSorley knew that he and his crew were facing a storm of considerable strength. At 1 a.m., when the Fitzgerald filed its regular report with the National Weather Service, rain was beating down heavily on the lake, and northeasterly winds were measured at 52 knots, or nearly 60 miles per hour. 10-foot waves chopped away at the side of the ship, and the temperature had dropped to 37 degrees. Visibility was down to 2 to 4 miles. The Fitz was about 20 miles south of Isle Royale. To Bernie Cooper on the Arthur Anderson, the storm was nothing he hadn't faced before. "We were having a fringe gale," he would remember. 30 to 35 knots, taking spray, and no green water on deck. You're listening to American Heritage on Voice Corps. My name is John Matthew Stockhausen. I'm continuing to read about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald from Michael Schumacher's 2005 book, Mighty Fitz. When the National Weather Service issued a severe storm warning in the wee hours of November 10th, Bernie Cooper radioed Ernest McSorley, and the two captains considered a change in direction. A more northeasterly course, they agreed, might be best. The wind was still howling in from the northeast, and if the two ships moved a little closer to the Canadian shore, they would be getting at least minimal protection from Ontario's lee shore. As it was, they'd been heading almost directly into the storm for hours. The two vessels had so far managed with very little difficulty, but the recently posted storm warning meant even heavier seas ahead. By moving toward the Canadian shore, they would cut the wind's fetch and avoid the worst of the building seas. McSorley had taken this route on any number of occasions, and he knew it well. That it lay farther north and east than the usual shipping route translated into more time on the lake, but at this point, with the shipping season almost completed and some downtime ahead, a few extra hours wasn't that big a deal. There would be plenty of time to relax when he returned to Ohio in a couple of weeks. The Fitz moved full speed ahead. Rain pelted its decks, and the wind rattled its wires. Around 3 in the morning it passed the Anderson, and as the night wore on and dawn approached, the distance increased between the two ships. The sky was just beginning to grow light when the storm reached Michigan's upper peninsula and the southern shores of Lake Superior. The cold front from Canada, sweeping down in the wake of the high pressure system that had passed to the north during the previous day, was dropping the temperatures that had been so uncommonly warm only 24 hours earlier. The rain would soon be changing to snow. McSorley and Cooper both knew that they had a day of hard sailing ahead of them. They'd be turning their ships and heading south in a matter of a few hours, and then they would be sailing into the eye of the storm. Once the storm had passed north of them, the winds would shift from the northeast to the northwest, and the freighters would be dealing with following seas, waves that built up from the west and crashed into them from behind. At that point, things could get nasty. At 7 a.m., McSorley picked up his radio telephone and called the Ogle Bay Norton offices in Cleveland. "Our ETA at the Sioux," he told them, "is indefinite because of the storm." Each of the Great Lakes could boast its own history of killer storms. As a rule, these storms were far more violent than weather forecasters had anticipated, with hurricane-force winds and waves as high as 2- or 3-story buildings. Such storms exacted mind-numbing tolls in vessels and lives. People working on the lakes had a long tradition of debating the intensity of the storms, especially ones they had just sailed through, but in some cases there was simply no room for dispute. One such storm racked Lake Superior from November 27th to 29th in 1905. For 3 days, the lake was nailed with murderous combinations of constant 70 to 80 mile per hour winds, sub-zero temperatures, blinding snow squalls, and massive waves. All told, 30 ships were destroyed, and many others grounded or severely damaged. Perhaps the most dramatic and heartbreaking of the disasters occurred in Duluth on November 27th, when the Matafa, a 430-foot freighter loaded with iron ore and towing the James Nasmith, a 366-foot barge, ran aground just outside the Duluth harbor, within view of thousands on land. The Matafa had sailed in relatively calm seas, only to head straight into the teeth of a vicious nor'easter and blinding snow. When heavy seas boarded the decks and threatened to capsize the ship and its consort, R.F. Humble, the Matafa's master, decided to return to Duluth. The two vessels fought the storm for hours, barely making way through the gigantic waves and blizzard. But they finally arrived at the entry of the Duluth harbor. Seeing that the Nasmith could never maneuver back through the piers, Captain Humble ordered it cut loose, leaving its crew at the mercy of a pitiless storm. The barge dropped its anchors. Just when it seemed it would be tossed onto the rocks, the anchors took hold, and the Nasmith was able to ride out the storm. Those aboard the Matafa were not as fortunate. For a brief period it looked as if the ship would make it to safety, but as it was inching between the piers, the wind and waves combined to smash it against a concrete pier head, spin it around, and sweep it back out toward the open sea. The Matafa's rudder was torn off. Unable to steer, the ship had no chance. The wind dashed it against the rocks about 100 feet from the beach. The Matafa broke and settled low in the water. Rescue was impossible in the winds and high seas, and with temperatures plunging to 20 below and a blizzard burying Duluth in drifting snow, there was little doubt about the fate of the Matafa's crew. The boilers had been disabled by water entering the stern section of the ship, and without heat the men were doomed to slowly freeze to death. A crowd, estimated at more than 10,000, gathered near the dock and along the shore, building fires and holding prayer vigils. By morning, the storm had dissipated enough that the Coast Guard was able to dispatch a lifeboat to the wreckage. As expected, the 9 men in the stern section had perished. 5 were missing and presumed washed overboard, and 4 were found dead of exposure, their frozen bodies encased in ice. Axes had to be used to chop the bodies out of the wreckage. The men in the bow section had survived by chopping up the captain's bathroom, burning the wood in his bathtub, and huddling together for warmth. As deadly as the storm of 1905 had been, it paled when compared to the November 9th through 12th storm 8 years later. A 4-day blow that hit all 5 of the Great Lakes, sinking 10 ships, seriously damaging or destroying 30 others, and claiming the lives of 235 men. On Lake Huron alone, 8 ships were lost with all hands, a toll of 178 lives. The entire upper Midwest fell victim. 22 inches of snow piled up in Cleveland, bringing the city to a halt. In Chicago, wind blew down the buildings in a park and scattered all their equipment. In Milwaukee, Lake Michigan waves pounded a newly built breakwater to scrap. 3 coal bridges were knocked down in Duluth. Telephone and electrical lines snapped, and highways were shut down by blowing and drifting snow. Areas around Lake Huron reported 4-foot drifts. Most storms move rapidly through a region, but this one took its time, gaining incredible power as it moved down Lake Superior and over Lake Huron. By the time the storm had moved out of the region on Tuesday, November 11th, bodies from 8 Lake Huron shipwrecks were washing ashore, many still in life preservers, most encrusted in ice. Mariners were given plenty of advance warning that the storm, approaching from the northwest, was not an ordinary autumn blow. The Coast Guard posted storm warnings along Lake Superior at noon on November 7th. Only a few hours later, the storm warnings were replaced by a rare hurricane warning. Winds were already exceeding 50 miles per hour. The forecasts failed to discourage some of the captains scheduled to sail. Business was business, and a canceled trip this late in the season meant lost revenue that in all likelihood couldn't be made up later. Heavy weather captains, so called for their willingness to sail in conditions that drove others to shelter, weren't easily intimidated. They commanded strong ships, and they had faced nasty storms in the past. The Huronic, a luxurious 321-foot passenger liner, became one of the storm's earliest victims. Downbound on Lake Superior, the liner wrote a wild ending to its last scheduled cruise of the season, when, suddenly and without warning, wind gusts blew in the ship's pilot house windows and began shaking the pilot house apart. With massive waves boarding his decks and wind dismantling his ship's superstructure, the Huronic's captain ordered his crew to chop away the splintered pilot house while the ship made a desperate run for Whitefish Point. The captain managed to ground his badly mangled vessel near the point, averting a sinking and saving the lives of its passengers. 2 ships, however, simply disappeared. The Henry B. Smith, a 525-footer loaded with 10,000 tons of iron ore, and the Leefield, a 250-foot Canadian freighter carrying grain, left their ports, disappeared in the storm, and were never heard from again. Wreckage and bodies of the Smith victims were eventually discovered, but the Leefield left no trace that it ever existed. Neither a scrap of wreckage nor any of the 17 victims was recovered. The Smith story offered a shocking illustration of the chances taken in the name of commerce. Captain Jimmy Owen was reportedly reluctant to sail in such conditions, but the ship's owners warned him that he would be fired if he didn't honor his schedule. These terrible storms each had its own name in sailors' lore. Like the White Hurricane of 1913 and the other great storms, the November 9th to 10th 1975 tempest on Lake Superior eventually earned its own title, the Edmund Fitzgerald Storm. You're listening to American Heritage on Voice Corps. My name is John Matthew Stockhausen. I'm continuing to read about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald from Michael Schumacher's 2005 book, Mighty Fitz. Sometime around 1 o'clock in the afternoon the weather broke, and the Fitz sailed in moderate seas under sunny skies. This was the eye of the storm. The crew welcomed the break. The ship had turned south an hour earlier, and while the early portion of the trip down the lake hadn't been as brutal as the hours when it was running head first into the storm, the Fitz still faced heavy seas. The storm, as forecast, had passed just west of Michipicoten Island and was heading northeast to Canada. The Fitz had moved into Canadian waters a couple of hours earlier, and it would remain there until the very end of its trip, when it would angle slightly west toward Whitefish Bay. No one aboard had any illusions about the benign weather they were now facing. As soon as the storm moved away from them, they'd be facing the roughest sailing of the trip. The wind would change direction at about the same time that the Fitzgerald was making its passage between Michipicoten and Caribou Islands, the only two islands of note on eastern Lake Superior. Ernest McSorley had kept in touch with the Anderson about its plans for this leg of the journey. Caribou Island, a heavily wooded 17-mile strip of land rising out of the lake, presented a possible hazard to any ship straying too close, as did the stretch of water between it and Michipicoten Island, which lay just to the north. In between the two islands, the lake's depth varied greatly. In a storm, the shallower areas could be rough, and Bernie Cooper told McSorley that he intended to alter his course. "I'm going to haul to the west for a while," he informed the Fitzgerald's captain. Cooper anticipated some extremely strong winds once the storm had moved further north, and he favored putting some extra distance between the Anderson and Michipicoten Island in the event that he started taking heavy seas off his stern. Even the big ships could be knocked off course by a storm, and Cooper wanted to play it safe. McSorley preferred to remain on his present course, although, as he told Cooper, the Fitzgerald was rolling some. The seas had picked up since the Fitz moved out of the eye of the storm, but the ship was still moving at full speed and experiencing no serious problems. McSorley figured he'd angle the Fitz between the islands. This would give him a straight shot into Whitefish Bay. The Fitz had already lost some time by taking the northern route after the storm warnings were posted. As long as it continued to handle the storm, there was no need to spend any more time on the lake than necessary. The Fitz managed well. By mid-afternoon it had passed Michipicoten Island and was heading south toward the much tinier Caribou Island. In calm seas, passage through this area demanded vigilance, but was relatively safe. Here, though, lay some of eastern Lake Superior's most treacherous shoals, and a seasoned captain like Ernest McSorley knew the danger they posed to a fully loaded ship bouncing in stormy waters. Shoals could destroy a ship in no time, especially if it grounded during a storm, when it could be dismantled by winds and waves before it was discovered and its crew removed by a rescue ship. Lake Superior's underwater terrain, particularly around the islands, could be extremely rugged, with the lake's floor rising from hundreds of feet in depth to less than 50 feet in very little distance. The waters around Isle Royale were littered with the remains of ships that had grounded on reefs. The worst loss of the 19th century occurred on November 7, 1885, when the 262-foot Canadian passenger ship Almoga hit the rocks near Isle Royale in a storm, breaking apart at the cost of 48 lives. The 22-mile channel between Michipicoten and Caribou Islands, though historically less lethal to ships than the areas around the Apostle Islands or Isle Royale, offered its own hazards to vessels passing through. More than half a century had passed since the Canadian Hydrographic Service had charted the area, and the charts produced during those surveys were still in use when McSorley and the Fitzgerald sailed into the area on the afternoon of November 10th. One reef, known as Chummy Bank, was located south of Michipicoten Island, and a much larger, deadlier reef, known as the Six Fathom Shoal, or North Bank Shoal, awaited north of Caribou. This treacherous area found the lake bottom rising from a depth of about 600 feet to 36 feet, a shallows that spelled potential disaster if a huge ore carrier, loaded with cargo and being rocked in violent seas, slammed into the lake bottom. Worse yet, an even shallower area, uncharted by the Canadian Hydrographic Service, lay directly in the Fitzgerald's path. After the wreck of the Fitz, the Canadian Hydrographic Service, at the request of the U.S. Coast Guard, would survey the area and discover that the Six Fathom Shoal actually extended a mile farther north than previously charted. In this area, the depth was as little as 31 feet. Although it will never be known for certain whether the Fitz touched bottom at this shoal, it is certain that something very serious happened to the Edmund Fitzgerald while it was making its way through these waters. The ship, pounding up and down in increasingly heavy seas, its hull bending to accommodate the action of the waves, strained to handle nature's abuse. Controlling the ship's movement in these seas became a major challenge, and those in the pilot house labored to keep the Fitz away from the troughs, which could break or capsize a vessel without warning. Blinding snow eddied outside the pilot house windows, obscuring what little visibility the Fitzgerald had under the darkening skies. Waves washed over the rails and onto the spar deck. The ship and its crew had never been more vulnerable. About 15 miles behind the Fitz, Bernie Cooper watched the Anderson's radar with growing concern. In directing his crew to take a course that would pass farther west of Michipicoten Island than the Fitzgerald, a course that had widened the distance between the two ships, Cooper had also chosen a course that would keep the Anderson a safer distance from the Six Fathom Shoal. Captain McSorley might have been shortening his trip by taking the course he had chosen, but he was also maneuvering his ship through very dangerous waters. "Look at this, Morgan," Cooper said to his first mate, pointing to the radar screen. "That's the Fitzgerald. He's in close to that six-fathom spot." Morgan Clark looked at the screen and agreed. "He sure looks like he's in the shoal area," he said. "He sure does," Cooper said. "He's in too close. He's closer than I'd want this ship to be." Cooper's worries were well-founded. At 3:35 p.m., only minutes after observing the Fitzgerald's position on his radar, he was on the radio telephone with Ernest McSorley, who had called the Anderson to report a problem. The Fitzgerald had sustained some damage. "I got problems," McSorley said. "I've got a fence rail down, some vents torn off, and I got a bad list." "Do you have your pumps going?" Cooper asked. "Yes," McSorley replied, "both of them." Cooper thought he detected concern, but not worry, in the captain's voice. Cooper wondered again about just how close the Fitz had come to the shoal. "Will you shadow me down the lake?" McSorley continued. "I'll reduce my speed so that you can overtake me." "Okay," Cooper said. "We'll do our best." After signing off, Cooper considered what might have happened to the Fitzgerald. The damage itself wasn't serious enough to sink the ship, but it seemed to indicate that the Fitz had hit a shoal. A fence rail just didn't come down in a storm. It had to experience an extreme change in tension, the kind of change that might occur if the ship hogged, either from actually striking a shoal or from tremendous bending in the turbulent waters around the shoal. Cooper had never heard of an instance where a wave had taken down a rail. The more he thought about it, the more convinced he became that the Fitzgerald had touched bottom somewhere near the Sixth Fathom Shoal. But for the time being, he had worries of his own. The Anderson was approaching Caribou Island, and Cooper had to see his ship through the area. You're listening to American Heritage on Voice Corps. My name is John Matthew Stockhausen. I'm continuing to read about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald from Michael Schumacher's 2005 book, Mighty Fitz. Shelter, for the Edmund Fitzgerald and the Arthur Anderson, was still at least 4 or 5 hours away. Hampered by a list and heavy seas, the Fitz steamed southeast with a disabling new problem. The wind had blown off the radar antennas on the pilot house roof, leaving the ship, in essence, sailing blind. At 4:10 p.m., Captain McSorley radioed the Anderson and reported the damage to Morgan Clark. "I've lost both radars," McSorley said. "Can you assist me in navigation?" Clark agreed without hesitation. The assistance was critical. The Fitzgerald was about 3 to 5 miles east of Caribou Island, with a long journey still ahead. Waves were cresting at 10 to 15 feet, with winds at more than 60 miles per hour. For a damaged ship to veer off course in these conditions could be fatal. Perhaps realizing that his ship was in grave peril, and not wanting to rely solely on the Anderson, which could lose its own radar as easily as the Fitz had, McSorley sent out a flurry of calls over the next hour. Shortly after talking to the Anderson, he also used his radio direction finder to get a bearing on the Whitefish Point lighthouse. The lighthouse, one of the oldest on Lake Superior, had been guiding ships to the shelter of Whitefish Point for more than a century. It would now be crucial on the final leg of the Fitzgerald's journey. However, the storm had knocked out the lighthouse's electricity, and after receiving an initial signal from it, the Fitz was unable to establish further contact. McSorley radioed the Grand Marais Coast Guard station and asked whether the Whitefish Point radio beacon was working. Gary Wiegand, standing in for the regular radioman, who had stepped out to aid in a boat launch, wasn't sure of the lighthouse's status. "Stand by," he told McSorley. "We don't have the equipment here to tell if it's operating properly. I'll call you back." Rather than wait for the Coast Guard's response, McSorley sent out a call to any vessel in the vicinity of Whitefish Point. He was answered by Captain Cedric Woodard of the Avifor, a 490-foot Swedish vessel that was just leaving Whitefish Bay. Between the snow squalls, Woodard could make out the outline of the lighthouse tower from his pilot house window. The lighthouse, he informed his caller, was not functioning. "Who is this?" he asked the unfamiliar voice on the radio telephone. "Who am I talking to?" "This is Captain McSorley." Woodard was shocked. He had known McSorley for 15 years, had spoken with him often, and had communicated with the Fitzgerald on countless occasions. This voice didn't sound anything at all like McSorley's. "I didn't recognize his voice at first," Woodard would say later. "It sounded like he had a cold, or he was weary, I don't know which. It was just not his voice." Woodard was further surprised when McSorley interrupted their conversation to call out to someone in the pilot house. "Don't allow nobody on deck," he shouted. What did that mean? No one in his right mind would have ventured out onto the deck in this weather unless something drastic was occurring. Woodard thought he heard McSorley shout something about a vent, but he couldn't make out what the captain was saying, and he didn't press the issue when McSorley returned to the call. McSorley, Woodard reasoned, knew what he was doing, and if he needed any help, he would have asked for it. McSorley heard from Gary Wiegand again, and the news was not good. Wiegand had called the Sault Ste. Marie station and was told that the Whitefish Point lighthouse had suffered a power outage. A crew was working to restore its signal. "Okay, thanks," McSorley replied. "We were just wondering because we haven't been able to get it for a while." McSorley concluded the conversation by promising to call back a little later. The captain, in fact, was growing desperate. Success in sailing through the storm depended on his staying in control of the Fitzgerald, and with the radar out, water boarding his ship, and the Whitefish Point lighthouse inoperative, he was gradually but most definitely losing control of his ship's destiny. He had reached the point where his fate, as well as that of his ship and crew, depended upon assistance from others. Water was now entering the Fitzgerald more freely than before, through hatch covers, the open vents, and other damage either topside or below the waterline. The Fitz had been gradually sinking lower in the water, and the storm, now hitting the ship full force, sent tons of green water over the spar deck. Sometime around 5:30, the Avifor contacted the Fitzgerald again. Woodard told McSorley that the Whitefish Point lighthouse's radio signal was still out, but that its light was operating again. "I'm very glad to hear it," McSorley said. But the good news about the Whitefish Point's light was short-lived. After operating for a brief period, the light shut down again, this time for what would prove to be the rest of the life of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The Arthur Anderson passed through the area around Caribou Island without a problem, but even Bernie Cooper was impressed by the violence of the seas around him. The National Weather Service, he'd say later, had accurately predicted the weather conditions, but somehow those conditions didn't coincide with what he had expected on the lake. In Cooper's words, the storm was blowing a gagger, producing surprisingly heavy seas. "It got nasty, and nasty very quickly," he remembered. The wind, Cooper noted, was blowing steady between 65 and 70 miles per hour, with gusts hitting 100, and quartering seas were breaking over the Anderson's starboard side. He had not expected this intensity. "Usually, up on Lake Superior, it takes 1 or 2 hours for a sea to build up," he pointed out later. "I don't know what the captain of the Fitzgerald was thinking, but in my own thinking, I figured we would be down a couple of hours above Whitefish before the sea got big enough to bother us. But the sea built in an hour, and it was blowing." Slightly more than 10 miles ahead of the Anderson, the Edmund Fitzgerald struggled to stay on course. Without radar or a light from Whitefish Point, it had to rely on periodic calls from the Anderson for readings on its position. When Morgan Clark noted the Fitz drifting a little to the left of the course to Whitefish Bay, he called the ship and pointed it out. Around 7 p.m. he called again, to let McSorley know that his ship was about 15 miles from Crisp Point, a mere 12 miles from Whitefish Point, and safety. "We haven't got far to go," he told the Fitzgerald's captain. "We'll soon have it made." "Yes," McSorley responded, "we will." "Terrible night for the Whitefish beacon not to be operating," Clark offered sympathetically, knowing how unnerving it had to be for the Fitz, tired and wounded, not to be able to see at least some symbol of safety. "Sure is," McSorley agreed. The Edmund Fitzgerald, now sailing into blizzard conditions, needed about 60 to 90 minutes to make Whitefish Bay. Lake Superior, unwilling to negotiate, offered a quarter of an hour. By early evening, the Edmund Fitzgerald had lost most of its freeboard. It was listing even more heavily to starboard, riding low in the water and taking a terrible pounding from the waves sweeping over its decks. Night had fallen, and for those trying to win the race against nature and time, darkness presented a new set of challenges. It was harder to gauge the height of the waves, harder to see and estimate the damage they inflicted, and all but impossible to determine whether the hatch covers were still secure. No one on board the Fitzgerald would have dared to step outside for a closer, better look. They had only guesswork, bolstered with hope. McSorley was making a run for it. The Fitzgerald was still plowing through the water. The Anderson was closing the distance between the two ships. Whitefish Bay was up ahead, and the Fitz was still armed with top-notch communications equipment if anything went wrong. The situation was extremely difficult, but not impossible, and with any luck at all, McSorley and his men would be on land in a couple of hours, exhausted but safe, with an unbelievable story to tell anyone who would listen. 10 miles behind the Fitz, the Arthur Anderson contended with the storm on its own terms. The Anderson handled the conditions much better than the ship it was trailing. But, as Bernie Cooper would later remember, Lake Superior seemed determined to swallow up his vessel. "I had a hatch crane on deck. It stood about 12 feet above our deck, and a couple of these seas that came across buried my entire deck in about 12 feet of water," he recalled. "That old girl, the Anderson, she came out shaking like a dog, shaking water off, water flying all over." It was about 6:30 in the evening. A short time later, two more gigantic waves boarded the Anderson's decks. The first rolled over the ship's poop deck, the second hit the bridge deck, nearly 35 feet above the water. The Anderson stood up to them, but these waves would haunt Cooper for years to come. By his calculations, if the heavy seas that hit his bridge deck continued down the lake, they would have reached the Fitz right about the time the ship disappeared. "I don't know," he said, "but I've often wondered if those two seas might have been the ones." You're listening to American Heritage on Voice Corps. My name is John Matthew Stockhausen. I'm continuing to read about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald from Michael Schumacher's 2005 book, Mighty Fitz. If the Anderson was shaking like a dog, the Fitzgerald was more like a wounded animal looking for a place to rest and recover. It rode perilously low in the water, leaning heavily to one side and helpless against the relentless onslaught of the storm. It was running blind, dependent upon the Anderson for direction. The beacon of the Whitefish Point lighthouse, still knocked out by the storm, offered no relief. And the Fitz was out of options. It was either reach safe harbor in Whitefish Bay or nothing. Captain McSorley, standing at the windows of a very quiet, tense pilot house, took a call from the Anderson at 7:10. "There's a target 19 miles dead ahead of us," Morgan Clark told him. "You're ahead of us, so the target is 9 miles on ahead." The math was simple. 10 minutes earlier, in an abbreviated conversation with the Fitz, Clark had informed McSorley that the Fitz was now running about 10 miles ahead, and 2 miles to the east, of the Anderson. "Well, am I going to clear?" McSorley asked the Anderson's first mate. The last thing the Fitz needed to worry about was a collision with another ship. Stranger things had happened on the lakes. "Yes, he's going to pass to the west of you." "Well, fine," McSorley responded. "Oh, by the way," Clark added, just as he was ready to sign off, "how are you making out with your problems?" "We're holding our own," McSorley answered. McSorley's were the last words heard from any of the souls aboard the Edmund Fitzgerald. Whether he believed them or whether they were wishful thinking will never be known. In all likelihood, in the darkness on the lake, with his ship cutting the distance to Whitefish Bay, though now at an agonizingly slow pace, McSorley believed what he was saying. And why not? The Fitz had survived to this point, and it was positioned between two vessels that, in the worst imaginable scenario, could answer a mayday call. But there would be no distress call. The first immense wave hit the Fitzgerald and completely overwhelmed it, pushing the ship's bow well beneath the lake's surface. The cargo hold, already burdened to its limit by the water taken on over the past several hours, flooded further. More than 26,000 tons of taconite pellets shifted forward, following gravity to the front of the ship. A second wall of water rolled over the ship, but it was almost anticlimactic. Assurance that the Edmund Fitzgerald's bow would never struggle back to the surface. It all happened too quickly for anyone aboard to do anything but react to the moment. The pilot house windows blew in, and inrushing torrents of water hurled everyone backward. The front of the ship, now angling downward toward the bottom of the lake, wavered unnaturally, sinking from the weight of the boarding water and rapidly shifting taconite pellets. At the back of the ship, the propeller continued to turn and drive the Fitzgerald forward. The middle of the ship buckled. The bow portion of the Fitz bent downward, laboring to drag the rest of the ship with it, while the stern section stubbornly held to the surface. The ship plunged to the depths in dark, frigid water, its running lights still on, every pocket of air filling with water from front to back of the vessel. The middle of the ship wrenched and twisted grotesquely. With metal tearing and grinding and compressing like an accordion, the sinking ship bellowed in protest hundreds of feet beneath the lake's surface. The Fitzgerald began to break apart. The weight of the water and cargo, now shifted as far forward as the hold would allow, added to the ship's downward momentum. The bow rammed into the floor of Lake Superior with tremendous force, plowing through mud and silt, laying a 30-foot gash in the lake bottom. Although it was sinking in fairly deep water, the Fitzgerald was longer than the water was deep, and as a result its stern remained on the surface as the bow hit the lake floor. This did not last long. The stern finally surrendered, rising out of the water, the propeller still turning, before disappearing beneath the surface. Water flooded into the back of the ship, hitting the boilers and setting off a series of fiery explosions. Throughout the tortured final moments of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the middle of the ship continued to twist and break. Hatch covers blew out, scattering taconite everywhere. The running lights flickered and went out. The ship's two lifeboats broke free and rose along with other flotsam toward the surface. The Fitz finally broke apart, the torque in the middle of the ship twisting the stern until it was actually upside down when it broke away from the rest of the ship and dropped to the lake floor. The bow came to a halt. The little air remaining in the Fitzgerald escaped and bubbled upward. Inside the remains of the Edmund Fitzgerald, 29 men lay dead or dying, some from drowning, others from the explosion of the boilers. Within a matter of minutes, one of the Great Lakes' finest ore carriers had become a gravesite. And no one on the surface had any idea of its fate. The storm showed some slight signs of breaking at just about the time the Fitz lost its fight. The snow stopped, and the skies cleared a bit. The lake still roiled with angry waves, and heavy gusts of wind rattled the Arthur Anderson's superstructure, but for all aboard the freighter, relief was in sight. It had been a difficult trip, and there was still a rough hour or so ahead, but Bernie Cooper, Morgan Clark, and the others on the Anderson could sense that the absolute worst was behind them. But now, with the snowstorm dissipating and visibility on Lake Superior greatly improved, the Fitzgerald's lights should have been visible between the Anderson and the tiny running lights dotting the horizon. At the very least, the Fitz should have turned up on the radar. It was nowhere to be found. Cooper fought off his fears of the worst. The Anderson's last communication with the Edmund Fitzgerald had been only 20 minutes earlier, and according to Morgan Clark, Captain McSorley had given no indication that the Fitz was in any immediate danger. Cooper and Clark grabbed their binoculars and searched the horizon for a sign, perhaps a dark silhouette or some kind of light. For a few hopeful moments, wheelsman Robert L. May thought he saw two lights, a red one and a white one. The red light, he concluded, belonged to a radio antenna, maybe from Coppermine Point. He focused on the white light, but when he tried to point it out, neither Cooper nor Clark could see it. The radar screen offered no answers. The crew in the Anderson's pilot house could clearly make out the other three ships on the radar, and for a couple of sweeps they thought they saw a faint blip where the Fitzgerald might have been. These proved to be deceptive, however, disappearing as quickly as they turned up. Cooper asked Clark to work further with the radar, while he radioed the Fitz. The radio telephone picked up nothing but dead air and static. A grim sense of reality now settled over the Anderson's pilot house. In all likelihood, the Edmund Fitzgerald was gone. It didn't seem possible, but there was no denying the mounting evidence. Morgan Clark had been unable to come up with anything on the radar, even when he adjusted it to focus only on large targets. Repeated calls to the Fitzgerald, each more frantic than the one before, yielded no response. Everything told us that the Fitz had gone down, Clark later confessed. Yet we couldn't believe it. She couldn't be gone. Cooper called the Sault Ste. Marie Coast Guard station, using Channel 16, the radio distress frequency. The Coast Guard, wanting to keep this emergency channel open, asked him to switch to Channel 12, but when he tried to call back on that channel, Cooper couldn't get through. The Coast Guard station, he learned, was experiencing difficulties with its communications system. Some antennas had been blown down by the storm. When he was eventually able to reach the Sault station, Cooper was in for another surprise. No one seemed especially concerned about the Fitz. There was another missing vessel out on the lake, a 16-foot outboard with two men on board, and the Coast Guard asked him to keep an eye out for it. 38 minutes after talking to the Coast Guard, Cooper contacted the station again. This time around he was more forceful in expressing his mounting fears about the Edmund Fitzgerald's fate. "This is the Anderson," he told the dispatcher. "I am very concerned with the welfare of the steamer Edmund Fitzgerald. He was right in front of us, experiencing a little difficulty. He was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships have passed him. I can see no lights as before, and I don't have him on radar. I just hope he didn't nosedive." The search for the Edmund Fitzgerald and its crew was not the U.S. Coast Guard's finest moment. For openers, Captain Bernie Cooper had had to all but plead with the Sault Ste. Marie station to take him seriously. "I considered it serious, but at the time it was not urgent," Petty Officer Philip Branch would testify in the Coast Guard hearings. "And it seemed to take an eternity to get any sort of search and rescue craft deployed to the scene." Nearly 2.5 hours passed between Cooper's first frantic call to the Sault station at 8:25 p.m. and the arrival of a rescuing HU-16 aircraft. By that point, between 3 and 3.5 hours after the loss of the Fitzgerald, the chances of finding survivors were almost nil. That's all for American Heritage. Your reader has been John Matthew Stockhausen. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCorps, your audio access to the world.